This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you feel like talking about politics with friends or family, you may have noticed it's gotten more difficult, more polarizing over the years. Now, a new report from The Atlantic is looking deeper into the feelings of partisan prejudice. The project measured political prejudice in the United States at the county level, showing how strong people's negative feelings are toward members of a different political party. For its part, Wisconsin came out as one of the more politically prejudiced states. Some of our neighbors, Iowa, Illinois, a little less so. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you sense a lot of political resentment in your part of Wisconsin? Or are people a little more cool-headed? Do you have friends or coworkers or a spouse who have different politics than you? How easy is that? How hard is that to deal with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Ripley is a journalist, author, and contributor to The Atlantic. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, how did you tackle this? How did you try to measure how much political prejudice we had around the country against people who disagree with us?
Well, it's hard to do, right? And it's necessarily imperfect. So... But what we did was something that hadn't really been done before, using some pretty complicated but pretty cool sort of big data analytics, working with a firm called PredictWise, and started by polling a lot of Americans about how they feel about the other side. So not how you feel about the other political party's ideas or policies or politicians even necessarily, but how you feel about Republican voters or Democratic voters. Like, how would you feel if your child married a Democrat or a Republican? And how well do you think the term selfish or compassionate describes Republicans or Democrats? Those kinds of questions. And then once we did that, we were able to know a lot about the people who answered that survey. And we were able to see which demographic traits seem to correlate with strong political partisanship or prejudice, as we called it, sort of intolerance for the other side above and beyond disagreeing on the ideas. And so we could see some interesting things, like, for example, being white seems to predict political prejudice against the other side, whichever side that may be. Being older, being living in or near a city, and being well-educated. So not all these things necessarily, but those things seem to go along with it. But maybe the most interesting to me was that we could see the political diversity at the neighborhood level for not just the people who answered the survey, but we can see that for the whole country. And we could find that the political diversity of your neighborhood is a really important factor in determining your level of political prejudice or intolerance. And so the less amount of diversity, politically speaking, the more intolerant.
Right. People have talked about online, the so-called filter bubble, in person, the great sort, people have called it, where in every way, we're making our lives so that we interact more and more with people who think roughly the same way we do. And you found definite pockets of that around the country, right?
Right. So you're right. It's true online for all of us and for our media consumption and so forth. It's easier to live in a bubble and just be sure that you're right all the time. But now we're seeing that at the neighborhood level, too. And we do see that that seems to go along with political prejudice. So where I live in Washington, D.C., and where you live in big parts of Wisconsin, I'm guessing, there's not a huge amount of political diversity, and that's a problem. Whereas the place we ended up focusing on, which is in upstate New York, had a surprising amount of political diversity at the neighborhood level. So people disagree with each other, definitely, but they're more likely to know well someone they disagree with.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. You found a book club with people from a pretty wide range of political perspectives, reading the same book, getting together and talking about it and getting along in a pretty civil way, which sometimes it seems like that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I spent some time with Fred Gehry, who's a minister in this town of Watertown, New York. And he would hold this weekly men's breakfast at his church. And it had people, what he described, to the right of Rush Limbaugh and to the left of him. And he describes himself as one notch below a communist. So it was a wide range, as you say. And they would read books. They read The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. They read about the opioid crisis. Really, you know, important timely books about big, difficult topics in American life. And the trick for him was to make sure everybody was well-fed to begin with. That was a big part of it. And he would cook all the food himself, but also to make sure that they knew each other and that they talked, as he put it, long enough to realize how much they didn't know, which I really liked. So in a lot of ways, these breakfasts were like the opposite of social media, right? Like they were slow and they were done with a tone of humility.
Talking to Amanda Ripley from The Atlantic, talking about a project looking at political prejudice around the United States. You could check out the maps at The Atlantic's website. Amanda, I want to get to some of the consequences here. One point that you focused on in some of your writing was the perception that people on the other side, in some cases even people on one's own side, are more extreme than they really are.
I'm really glad you brought that up because this is the reason why this matters. There's some really compelling research that's coming out that's showing that as we become more and more divided, we are making more and more mistakes politically and also personally about one another. Once you get into stereotyping millions and millions of people, you make mistakes. That is the nature of stereotyping, right? So we find that Republicans now think that other Republicans are further to the right than they actually are on the issues. And Democrats think Republicans are even further to the right than Republicans think, and vice versa. So we think that we found in the research that Republicans tend to think that Democrats are more radical and godless than they actually are. And Democrats think that Republicans are far richer and more cruel towards the poor and others than they actually are. So once you start making these mistakes, it has big implications. There's even a study that's found that people are less likely to get their kids vaccinated when the other party has control of the White House. So there are all these kinds of unexpected effects that come from this kind of divide in the country.
We're talking to journalist and author Amanda Ripley about a project she worked on mapping out levels of partisan prejudice in America and how we look at people with different political opinions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. In your part of the state, do you think you are able to have civil conversations with people who have different political opinions than you do? Or do you agree to disagree? Or have you seen people cutting ties with friends or family members just because they can't overcome those differences? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to journalist Amanda Ripley about political prejudice in America. She worked on a new project from The Atlantic called The Geography of Partisan Prejudice, mapping out around the nation how strongly people feel about people with different opinions, how negatively they feel about them. Amanda, a worry you have in your writing is that at some point we're maybe dehumanizing people on the other side of the political spectrum. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, nearly 20% of Democrats and Republicans say that many members of the other side, quote, lack the traits to be considered fully human, according to a 2017 survey by political scientists Nathan Calmo and Liliana Mason. So these are the kinds of studies that we have seen in other countries in conflict zones. And once you start getting into this where the conflict escalates to such a point where the other side seems insane and you stop really speaking the same language, like you see something happen and you see it totally differently and you are totally baffled by the other side, then you start to typically see this kind of demonization and dehumanization. And the problem with that is that it almost eventually leads to violence if it's not somehow mitigated, right? Because the conflict just escalates and escalates. So this is very concerning for people who study conflict and have been in conflict zones all over the world.
And another consequence is, again, from what you wrote about this, if people on one side have mistaken impressions of the other side, think they're more extreme than they are, well, eventually that sort of thinking is going to go up to political leaders, party leaders, elected officials, that kind of thing. And they might make different decisions than they might have with better information.
I think it started with political leaders, particularly at the national level, and also with political pundits in the media. So I think that it had really started there years ago with this sort of demonizing of the other side. And this is what I think I would love to see us get to, a place where we can see how we're being, all of us are being manipulated. Like, there are politicians, media outlets, and platforms that are profiting and building their brands off of us being enraged at each other. And the more I kind of recognize that, it really changes the way I react to some of these messages. So I think it's important to see how we're all kind of getting played by a small number of companies and individuals who have a lot to gain by pitting us against one another and really keeping us at each other's throats. And so to your point, yes, when this happens at all levels, eventually government grinds to a halt and fixable problems that most Americans want to see fixed and even agree on the solutions don't get fixed because of the conflict.
I know from past conversations, you're interested in more productive conversations, better ways to talk to each other, even if we disagree with each other. For somebody listening, what advice would you give them if they're in that situation? They have this, if they're lucky enough to have a politically diverse group of friends and family members, how do they keep that alive in a happy way?
That's a really good question, because if you're lucky enough to live in a place or have family, well, we don't usually see this as lucky, but I'm now starting to see it as lucky. If you have family members who disagree with you politically, there is an opportunity there. And it's actually really important. I think those of us who don't get to have those conversations are turning out to have some ignorance about the other side in ways we don't realize. So while those conversations are definitely can be very awkward and risky, it's important to have them. And there are good and bad ways to have them, for sure. But one of the rules of thumb that I've learned from people who do this all the time is to really try to keep it personal, to start with the question and try to be curious if you possibly can, to start with the question, you know, how did you come to think the way you do about this, and really listen and show the person you've listened. And then you'll find, and this is just sort of a basic algorithm of human behavior, when people are dug in on something, they just want to feel heard. Like, they will then listen to another point of view. They may even open their minds to another point of view. They may not. But it's like a prerequisite that they feel heard, even if you disagree with them, that they believe you heard what they said. And so that is a different way of understanding persuasion than I think what we see, you know, on cable TV news.
And briefly, Amanda, as we wrap up, thoughts for how we in the media can facilitate better conversations like that?
There's a huge opportunity for newspapers and radio and media outlets to really ask their readers and their audiences, what do you want us to talk about on this upcoming election, or when it comes to crime or education, and really build trust that way by listening to your listeners and your readers and kind of becoming allies with them and being more transparent about what you're doing. And then as often as possible, when you're covering a really polarizing conflict or controversy, try to complicate the narrative. Like, don't cut the parts that don't fit people's stereotypes, right? Include those parts. Like, we often do cut those parts because, you know, we think it's too complicated. But in a time of high conflict, like we are in the United States, it is bad journalism to let things remain oversimplified. There is almost always more complexity to real humans. That may not be the case, right, with celebrities or politicians, but with regular voters and regular issues, there's a huge amount of complexity. And it's important, I think, to really amplify that in a time of polarization.
Amanda, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Amanda Ripley, author and journalist. She joined us to talk about her reporting for The Atlantic about partisan political prejudice in America and how to reach past it with better conversations.